think that the agencies that were involved in it determined that this was the most environmentally sensitive solution to the problem if you're going to have this mine.
The U.S. Supreme Court takes up the Kensington Mine case. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 12th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an important step towards congressional approval of a new road to Cold Bay.
I'm feeling pretty confident that we will be moving this very important public lands measure to final passage.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just Pick, Click, Give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
Once again, an avalanche has destroyed a tower along the Snetisham Hydroelectric Project south of Juneau, knocking out low-cost power to the capital city. Diesel generators are now providing electricity to Juneau. A borough-wide power outage lasted less than an hour and a half this afternoon. While Alaska Electric Light and Power crews were flying over the Snetisham line to search for the cause, the company started diesel generators. AEL&P Vice President Scott Willis says the avalanche hit Tower 3-5, one of several towers wiped out last April by a series of large snow slides. Willis says the utility company has been controlling avalanches all winter as late as yesterday.
We were not doing control work today. We did control work there yesterday, dropping explosives out of the helicopter, but the visibility didn't allow them to get high up on the mountain. They only got about halfway up the mountain, bringing down small avalanches. As I understand, they were not doing control work today, so this was just a natural avalanche that cut loose and destroyed this tower.
Willis says the extent of the damage to Tower 3-5 will not be known until linemen can get on the ground. Willis says he doesn't know yet how long Juneau will have to rely on diesel generation. Capital City residents are familiar with conservation and cut electrical consumption more than 30% within days after last April's snow slides. At one point, Juneau residents were paying nearly 53 cents a kilowatt hour, the highest in the state. Juneau was on diesel for about 45 days at that time. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today on whether mining company Core Alaska can dump tailings in a lake near Juneau. The waste from the gold mine would kill everything in Lower Slate Lake, but the company and the Army Corps of Engineers say the lake would eventually be revitalized. As APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington, the case could set precedent for how mining waste is disposed of in the nation's waterways.
Mining company Core Alaska initially got permission from the Army Corps of Engineers to dump its slurry into Lower Slate Lake, about 45 miles north of Juneau. But when environmentalists sued, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down the permit, saying the plan violated the Clean Water Act. On Monday morning, the two sides presented their cases to the nation's highest court. It comes down to who regulates fill, or solid waste, as it's dumped into a waterway, the Army Corps or the Environmental Protection Agency. Another question is what exactly qualifies as fill. The first to present, siding with the mine, was Gregory Garr, Solicitor General with the Department of Justice. He represented the Army Corps of Engineers. Garr argued that fill material, like the mine tailings, should be permitted under the Corps, so it isn't subject to the guidelines issued by the EPA under the Clean Water Act. Justice David Souter provided a tough line of questioning. He pointed out that existing regulations say such wastewater shouldn't be released into a water body, but that the Corps seems to be making an exception just because it's calling it fill in this case. Souter called that a flat contradiction. Garr said the area would be sealed off and considered impounded, but Souter pressed and said it was, quote, pretty cold comfort to call a natural lake an impoundment area. He asked if a lake in the Everglades or the Great Salt Lake could fall into that category someday, too, and said a lake is different than a settling pond. When Gar said the Corps has rigorous environmental guidelines, Souter said that sounded like Orwellian logic, since the lake's natural life would be destroyed. And Souter said whether the fish would die from toxic pollutants or, as Gar argued, just from relatively harmless fill settling at the bottom of the lake, it still sounded like pollution. Next up to continue the argument for the mine was Ted Olson, a former Solicitor General under President George W. Bush, speaking on behalf of Core Alaska. He agreed that fill is different than other effluent, and he pointed out that even if the Army Corps has oversight, it still has to follow EPA guidelines. While the tailings would kill all wildlife in the lake, Olson said when Core Alaska restores it, the lake will in fact be bigger, with a better aquatic system. However, Olson conceded to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg that there was no guarantee the lake would be restored, but said it is required under the permit. Olson said using the lake is the most environmentally sound plan.
The alternative of stacking these tailings into an immense mountain of tailings that will be up to 200 feet high and 100 acres maybe or something like that, a great deal bigger than Pentagon, which will be then subject to have rain coming down on it. I think that the agencies that were involved in it determined that this was the most environmentally sensitive solution to the problem if you're going to have this mine.
The image of a tailings pile the size of the Pentagon seemed to catch the justices' imagination and was brought up repeatedly during arguments, eliciting a laugh from the audience when Justice Antonin Scalia described it as an ash pentagon. But the environmental group Southeast Alaska Conservation Council says that's an exaggeration based on an old model, and the actual tailings pile would be about 60 feet high. The lawyer who argued for the environmentalists, Tom Waldo, with Earth Justice, presented his argument after the petitioners. He said a land-based waste site would actually be better.
Certainly, it's not going to be pretty. The disposing of mine waste has impacts no matter where you put it. But the idea of the Clean Water Act is to protect the quality of the nation's waters, and it is much better to dispose of those tailings on dry land than to dump them into a lake or a river or a stream.
As Waldo criticized the plan to kill everything in Lower Slate Lake, Chief Justice Roberts pointed out that its main population, Dolly Varden Char, are not endangered species. Waldo said regardless, they should be protected under the Clean Water Act. Justice Scalia noted that the EPA could have vetoed the permit, but didn't. Waldo said that unfortunately, the EPA has taken the position that if the discharge is classified as fill material, it doesn't matter how bad the effects are, it's exempt from limitations. The latest definition of fill came in 2002 during the Bush administration. Waldo said after the arguments that perhaps the new incoming Obama administration would have a different perspective.
We will certainly ask the new administration to reverse this policy decision by the Bush administration. At this time, I have no ability to predict what they might do or when they might do it.
For now, though, it's up to the justices, who will rule on the Kensington mine case later this year. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The Senate has advanced a massive lands bill, which includes a land swap in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge on the Alaska Peninsula. The huge package brings together 160 lands and parks bills and designates 2 million acres of wilderness throughout the U.S. It would cost $10 billion. Yesterday's unusual Sunday vote was led by Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada. By a 66-12 vote, the Senate passed a cloture motion, which shuts down debate and says the Senate can proceed to a vote on the actual bill. Reid pushed for yesterday's vote to stop a threatened filibuster by Oklahoma Republican Tom Coburn, who has called the lands bill wasteful. But in Alaska, as well as other western states like Utah, it has Republican support. Senator Lisa Murkowski voted to advance the bill. She says it includes land conveyances and designations that may seem small to some, but to individual communities, especially in the West, they're long awaited and significant.
Well, some may think that this is not something that we need to be doing at this point in time, that we should be focusing on the economy. I would make the argument these are matters that have been reviewed by the committees, have been waiting for final passage for close to 2 years.
Senator Murkowski says while the bill may seem massive, its individual elements have passed the scrutiny of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, on which she sits. Murkowski says she's optimistic the bill will pass the Senate this week.
We do have another cloture vote in between, but given the vote tallies that we saw yesterday, I'm feeling pretty confident that we will be moving this very important public lands measure to final passage.
Murkowski supports the Eisenbeck land swap, which would allow the state to build a road in what's now designated wilderness. The village of King Cove wants the road to connect to Cold Bay and its airport. Residents say they need it for emergency purposes, but the community already has a hovercraft to travel across the bay, and environmentalists say the land is irreplaceable and should be kept off limits. They say the development will hurt waterfowl and other wildlife. However, many environmentalists are supporting the massive lands package overall because of its wilderness designations and protection of land and water areas. Alaska's new senator, Democrat Mark Begich, also voted to advance the bill in one of his first votes cast in his new job.
You know, obviously, kind of a dramatic feeling when you're going out there and you're doing your first roll call vote. You know, there was the vote on swearing in just to be there, but this was the first issue roll call vote, so it was very nice to be part of something that's bipartisan and actually wins on the first time out. You know, that's not a bad way to start.
Begich says he plans to vote in favor of the lands package if it does come up for a floor vote this week. If it passes the Senate, it will then move to the House. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, assessing a major problem for Alaska's seniors.
I opened up my wallet to give her my information, and she saw the Medicare card, and she said, "I'm sorry, we can't take you."
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
If the goal of Friday's forum on Medicare was to find a local way to bring immediate relief to Anchorage seniors, it probably failed. However, if the idea was to strengthen the resolve of those working for some partial assistance, the 3 hours appeared well spent. KSK's Len Anderson reports.
Of the dozen panelists, the first one to speak was Donia Clements, a retired senior under Medicare.
The story I have to tell this morning is not really unique. I thought it was in the beginning, but then I discovered that many, many seniors in Anchorage have had the same experiences that my husband and I have had.
She and her husband had gone to the same doctor for 10 years. Suddenly, they received a letter saying the doctor was no longer taking Medicare patients. Later, he told Clements that between the low reimbursement and the paperwork, he was losing up to $65,000 a year. Clements wasn't too disturbed. She thought another doctor would be easy enough to find.
After making about 60 to 65 telephone calls and getting the same response from doctors, no new Medicare patients, I was very, very discouraged.
Clements says they eventually found a doctor who accepted them, but within months, his clinic also dropped all Medicare clients. Clements now realizes the significance of an incident at an urgent care clinic that occurred while she was still working.
I opened up my wallet to give her my information, and she saw the Medicare card, and she said, "I'm sorry, we can't take you." And I said, "But this is, you know, it's not my primary. Sorry, we don't deal with Medicare at all." So it is a very huge problem in our city.
Clements and her husband eventually signed a contract with a doctor where they pay 75% of the regular fees, but cannot use their Medicare to do so. The Anchorage Health and Human Services Department, AARP Alaska, Anchorage Health and Human Services Commission, and the Anchorage Senior Citizens Advisory Commission were the sponsors of a Medicare Forum, Strategies for Change. According to Diane Engel, director of the Health and Human Services Department, seniors comprise about 7% of Anchorage's population. That's about 21,000 residents and is expected to double by 2020. About half rely on Medicare as their sole insurance. Besides seniors, about 20% of Alaska's Medicare beneficiaries are people with disabilities. They, too, are encountering service problems. All the panelists agreed Medicare is a federal program and the ultimate solution would have to come from Washington, D.C. The current president of the State American Medical Association, Tom Vasiloff, noted some federal relief came when Alaska's congressional delegation obtained a temporary 35% boost specifically for Alaska Medicare reimbursements.
Unfortunately, many of my primary care colleagues felt that it's not going to necessarily change what they're doing now, but it will keep them from decreasing the number of Medicare patients or opting out of Medicare. So it did provide that stimulation.
The loss to the doctor is $77 per visit.
Joan Fisher directs Anchorage's Neighborhood Health Clinic located in Fairview. She says her center falls under a special federal category and receives more reimbursement than other Alaskan doctors. Thus, the clinic only loses $17 per Medicare visit. On the other hand, Fisher says the higher reimbursement comes with a federal demand.
We also are required as an FQHC to participate in Medicare and Medicaid, so I can't drop out of participating in Medicare and get paid by them anymore. They will cancel out my grant.
One partial remedy repeated by several panelists was to expand the Neighborhood Health Center. Another favored proposal called for creation of a senior Medicare clinic in Anchorage. Long-term options included more preventative programs and especially more training and recruiting programs for primary doctors and physician assistants. All the ideas require state funding. While not denying the goals, panelist and state representative Mike Dugan said advocates needed to be prepared for legislative grilling, especially with the current economic uncertainties. He also pointed out all the legislative panelists were Democrats. None were members of the majority Republican Party. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
A Southeast Alaska lawmaker is trying to get more college students to come back to the state. He's filed a bill that would help graduates in some hard-to-fill professions pay back their loans. The measure is one of more than 100 bills pre-filed by lawmakers Friday. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Representative Bill Thomas wants to see more young Alaskans return to the state.
I'm tired of watching our students, our children leave Alaska and not come back because, you know, there's no incentive for them to come back.
The Haines Republican has authored a bill that would pay back loans for some students. It targets four professions he says are short on workers.
Right now, we have a need for nurses. We have a need for fishing game biologists, need for teachers, and the need for dentists. We send our students out of state to get an education. When they get done, they at least will have a home here for them to come back.
Thomas's measure would pay back only Alaska student loans. Graduates would have to work 4 years in a rural area or 6 years in an urban community to see their debts fully covered. He hopes that's long enough for young adults to settle down.
Once a person has a job for 6 or 8 years, depending on how long the program is going to be, I think they're pretty well committed then and will stay here.
Rural towns are defined as having no more than 5,500 people. They must also have no road connection to Anchorage or Fairbanks. Residents of communities with no more than 1,500 people that do have a road connection would also qualify. Alaska used to forgive half of loans for students who remained in or returned to the state after graduation, but that ended about 20 years ago because it cost too much. It also had a high default rate. That's because students borrowed money assuming they would meet the forgiveness program's guidelines, but many didn't. Diane Behrens is executive director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, which runs the student loan program.
The challenges there is you're asking a person at a very early point in their post-secondary career to make decisions about what field they'll be in and where they're willing to work in order to borrow that debt. And our experience here is that it is not particularly effective in terms of the percentage of borrowers who actually end up qualifying for the benefit.
Barron says a loan repayment program works better than a forgiveness program. That's because students know it only kicks in when they get a job.
With loan repayment, typically what happens is a person, you know, just accrues their educational debt. They're ready to serve in a profession, and they may look around for states that have programs that offer them this additional benefit above and beyond their compensation.
The bill calls for the state to pay for the program out of its general fund. Thomas says that could keep it from going very far this year.
It's going to be a problem because of the funding situation we have right now and a lack of money with the state. It may sit a year and then we'll have to look at it next year. I don't plan on getting it through this first session.
Alaska already has a few programs helping pay back student loans. One funds up to half the debt for fisheries students with donations made in exchange for state fish tax credits. Another pays the full debt of some future teachers planning to work in rural schools, but both have more limitations than Thomas's bill calls for. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The collapse of the market for recycled materials late last year has lowered income for the Sitka Recycling Program, but has not made recycling any more expensive than handling regular trash. Local officials want to maintain the growing recycling program in its current form until the global commodities market rebounds. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Sitka, like some other southeast communities, ships its garbage south to Washington with a solid waste contractor, Rabanco, a subsidiary of Allied Waste, where it is eventually landfilled. Since 2005, Sitka has also sorted and shipped newsprint, mixed paper, cardboard, and tin cans south along with its trash. Those materials are diverted and sold in the global commodities market, and Sitka receives a cut of the proceeds in the form of a rebate. In December of last year, the bottom fell out of the market for some recyclables, particularly mixed paper, and those materials became almost worthless. Although it doesn't pay as well as it did just a few months ago, Scott Berlinski, the operations chief in the Public Works Department, says recycling is not costing Sitkans anymore.
The message to the community is keep recycling. We expect that commodities prices will eventually recover. It's anybody's guess. We don't have any more of a crystal ball than anyone else. But when the global economies recover, commodities prices will come up. We'll be back into a net positive cash position. But we're not losing money under the status quo.
Berlinski crunched the numbers and has concluded that Sitka was breaking even on recycling even as the market bottomed out in December. What helps insulate Sitka from losses in recycling is the fact that glass, although it is collected at the Catlan Street Recycling Center, never leaves the island.
Glass is very heavy and a very low-value recyclable commodity, and we handle glass locally. We crush it and process it for reuse here, so we're not paying to ship it out.
Berlinski says the crushed glass is not used to sand roads. There's actually a relatively small amount of final product. The DEC allows the wastewater department to use it in place of gravel to isolate biosolids in the landfill. Much of the news recently at the national level concerning recycling has been very dire. The New York Times in December ran an article under the headline, "Trash Has Crashed," and reported that some recycling contractors were moving materials to landfills rather than selling them at below-cost prices. Recycling participation in Sitka has grown steadily since the inception of the program and had its best year in 2008 with 1.5 million pounds of materials moving through the Catlan Street Center, over 150 tons more than in 2007. Norm Campbell heads Recycle Sitka. He says breaking even in current market conditions is a good thing.
Those people that I talk to that I run into at the recycling center or on the street are generally in favor of recycling, and they want to make sure that the program isn't going to go away based on this scenario that we're living through right now. I've been trying to be really cautious about you know, what I'm telling people, because we just recently got this, what I consider excellent news about the fact that we can still just about break even and handle our waste in a responsible way.
Campbell says people tend to lump recyclables together, and the market news is not bad for all materials. The price for number one and two plastic hasn't fallen at all. It remains over $400 a ton. Aluminum, which in Sitka is collected by the Barracuda Swim Club, has dropped from about $1,400 a ton to $1,000 a ton. And while other scrap metals have dropped from several hundred dollars a ton, at $30 to $60 a ton, they're not worthless. Despite the collapse of prices in some materials, Campbell would like to explore ways to expand Sitka's program. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Sitka residents counted nearly 6,000 birds during the Audubon Christmas bird count this year. The annual count was held in Sitka in early January to accommodate busy holiday schedules for the participants. Despite bad weather, 33 people managed to identify 60 species of birds, including many shorebirds seen from the beach. Count organizer Jen Cedarleaf says the rarest sighting was a pair of yellow-billed loons, one of which had been observed in the Sitka Channel long before the official count.
They winter south, and they nest up north. So to have some stay in Sitka for the entire winter is kind of unusual. And we do have one that's been hanging out in the channel for months now. And I'm hoping he sticks around a little longer since I haven't seen him yet.
Cedarleaf says the Audubon Christmas bird count began more than a century ago in the northeastern United States and replaced the tradition of shooting birds over the holidays. The data collected in the counts nationwide has allowed biologists to track significant trends in bird populations. Declines in some species has led to conservation efforts. Increases in some species have prompted questions about environmental conditions that cause birds to thrive. Sitkins counted almost twice as many fox sparrows over the previous high record for the event. Cedarleaf thinks warmer than usual conditions in the early winter may have contributed to the new record. Another species, the Lincoln sparrow, probably remained longer than usual for the same reason. Cedarleaf says some migratory species stay put when conditions are good.
We also did have a number of red-breasted nuthatches, which are not normal for this year, but a friend of mine has had them out at her house at her feeder all winter, so she's been keeping them around.
The number one bird for the Sitka count this year was the pine siskin, with more than 1,100 individuals counted, followed by the northwestern crow at 700 and the common raven at 680. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemary Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Rasmussen Foundation is announcing March 1st as the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Awards grant, which provides funding directly to artists to support their creative work. You can sign up to participate in one of the Rasmussen information sessions to be held the week of January 19th by calling 297-2876 or go online at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.